Jennifer, can I just actually make a very quick, I'll call it correction of what I said previously about this one enforcement case I was referring to? The company I was thinking about was Boston Scientific, and unfortunately, I probably thought there was a case against the people with the confirmations because perhaps I thought there should have been at the time, but it involved a Japanese subsidiary. There was 40 employees at the company that were involved. But what was surprising was that there was 143 independent distributors that participated in the fraud in terms of sending in false confirmations. Anyway, that was a commission enforcement case several years back involving Boston Scientific. But to the best of my knowledge, there was no action taken against the people that submitted the false confirmations.
Okay, thanks, Wayne. All right, so moving into emerging issues discussion, as I indicated this morning, we've moved this discussion till now after lunch. Really, the primary reason was we've been hearing a lot about fair value, although that's the FASB's been deliberating, and that we've been hearing whether or not the PCAOB should issue any type of guidance that would be helpful to auditors in connection with auditing under these new accounting standards or guidance issued by the FASB. We are interested in that issue, and so we'll start off with that. I've asked Peter from the FASB to give an overview of what the FASB board decided this morning and what we can expect to see. And then we can have a discussion. So, Peter, if you're ready.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks.
I did place a call, but since I was paying for the call myself, I kept it short. So I'll do the best I can. Let me start with there were really three actions related to fair value. So I'll just take them one at a time. In terms of this, what we refer to as the Statement 157 project or the FSP 157E, let me preface it by saying the objective was to provide application guidance on what you do when the market for an asset decreases significantly, and to provide additional information about identifying orderly and non-orderly transactions. The scope of that initiative is fair value measurements governed by Statement 157. One of the things, and maybe what I should say is, for the large part, the decisions made this morning are in line with the proposals that were published 2 or 3 weeks ago. There were a couple of variations. But what the board did say is that they need to make a much clearer statement that the measurement objective is the same as it was. It's the price for an orderly transaction at the measurement date. And what that means is reflecting the market that exists, not some other hypothetical market. And so the issue is, how do you evaluate actual transaction prices, those market trades that are available? And so the board is providing a list of factors. I think we had 7 of them in the ED. There were some additional factors that were suggested in the comment letters, which the board has reviewed and agreed to add some of those. They were not discussed in detail, or they were not specifically identified at the board meeting this morning. We've eliminated the two-step process for those who are familiar with the proposals. We had a two-step process where first you would identify whether the market was active or inactive, and if inactive, then you had some, there was a presumption that any transactions that were observable, there'd be the presumption that they were not orderly. That presumption has been removed. And so it's more of the concept is you should look at all data points and that it's appropriate to use alternative valuation techniques, a model, so to speak. I won't list the factors that were included. The circumstances for, so if there's observable trades, you may not have any information to be able to assess whether it was orderly or not. If you're not involved in the transaction, it might be hard to tell. If you can determine that it is orderly, then you probably want to go ahead and use it. If you can determine that it's not, you would wait that or not use it. The factors that you would consider are whether the transaction was because of a bankruptcy or someone heading towards bankruptcy, There were a couple of others. If the transaction was marketed to a single participant, or if you're able to determine that the price was really an outlier. I think the big change was the removal of the presumption that all distressed all transactions in an inactive market are distressed. The board wants to make clear that broker quotes or pricing services would be relevant if the methodology used to develop them is compliant with Statement 157. We're going to try to provide clearer examples. We had examples in the proposals. We're trying to clear those up to provide a little bit more of application guidance. And there was an added disclosure from the ED, really just to talk about the valuation techniques used and the inputs at a fairly granular level by asset class. We're referencing asset classes that are in 115 or 133 or whatever it is the guidances that you're using that tells you to measure at fair value. I'm going to come back to effective date afterwards because they're all linked together. On the issue we called other than temporary impairment, OTTI, the scope is debt securities. And again, for the large part, the decisions were in line with the proposals. The idea is that you would separate the credit from the non-credit impairment. The recognition trigger is based on intent to sell, or it's more likely than not that you will have to sell. If you cannot sustain that you're not going to be compelled, if you can't sustain that you are not going to be able to have to sell, then all the losses would go through earnings. But if you don't have an intent to sell, then the credit piece would go through earnings and the non-credit portion would go outside of earnings to OCI. The credit portion, in the way we're characterizing it, is based on the expected cash flows. We reference a FAS 114 type of an approach. There was some suggestions from some of the comment letters that the only loss that should be recognized in earnings, should be recognized at all, was the credit losses. And to do otherwise is inconsistent with the notion of hold to maturity. The board rejected that idea. In the income statement, both pieces would be shown. So it's a gross basis, so to speak. You have the total impairment minus the non-credit that's going to go to OCI. In terms of subsequent accounting, there would be a natural accretion the impairments that were recognized outside of earnings that will get you back ultimately to par. And when this is adopted, in the period that it's adopted, at the beginning of that period, beginning of that quarter, there would be a reclass between retained earnings and AOCI for the non-credit losses previously taken. And again, we added some disclosures, more information about inputs. The disclosures are required for interim and annual periods. Again, disaggregation by type of asset. We've identified the types of assets that we thought were good examples. And a description of methodologies used, and also a roll forward that would roll forward the amounts of the impairments from period to period. The other thing, and it might have been a little bit of a sleeper, but what the board also did was they required the disclosures that are a part of Statement 107 annually. They required on a quarterly basis. So that was a pretty minor change. In terms of effective dates, the board was trying to sync all of these up together. So where they landed, it's a little bit cumbersome. Basically, we're marrying up the FAS 157 and the other than temporary impairments together. So if you adopt one, you have to adopt the other, and vice versa. But you don't have to adopt 107 at the same time. However, if you adopt the 107, then you have to do the fair value and the OTTI. Okay, so when is it effective? It's going to be required for periods ended after June 15th, 09, with earlier adoption permitted for periods ending after March 15th. And I think that's all I have.
Okay, thank you. Mark, I believe.
Yeah, thanks, Janet. Thank you, Peter, for that summary. I would like just like to acknowledge that the new guidance on both 157 for the valuation of securities in inactive markets and also on 115 with respect to the credit portion of OTTI, we will be looking to see whether or not any conforming amendments to existing standards are appropriate, and any additional guidance would be helpful. And we will, of course, the discussion that we have following will be of importance to that consideration. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. Okay, let's open it up for any comments regarding that point. If anyone has any, I thought we would just devote any comments to this fair value issue, whether or not we should need to make any conforming amendments or issue guidance, as Mark just indicated. And then once we finish that, open it up for discussion of other emerging issues in general.
Jen, I may have mentioned this last night, but it just as a reminder that our remit is the audit implications and not the accounting side. So that to the extent that you can direct your comments toward the audit implications, that's what we're looking for in this portion of the conversation.
Hal.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time talking to probably 85% of the companies in the S&P 500, in particular the banks that are having to deal with 157. And one of the comments that we get back pretty consistently is that the companies read the standard, but the auditor, quote, the auditor, cannot move off of the last price. So even though there may be, all signs that there was the last price was a distressed price, there seems to be an unwillingness or misunderstanding of what the standard requires, but they view that as the only answer, and they can't seem to get beyond some quoted price, no matter how distressed it may be. So I was looking for feedback, comments. Are we hearing the correct things from the banks? The banks are blaming on the auditors, and we're hearing other people blaming it on others. I don't know who to believe at this point.
Well, I think that was a good comment, and certainly look to others on the SAG that have experience or observations on that. Certainly the auditors, they audit to the accounting framework. And what you're indicating is there's some tension kind of regarding that, the interpretation of that. Interested in comments from the auditors that are here, or if others have any similar views or different views? Jim Schnur?
Well, I think one of the things you said gets to the point, which is they believe the transactions that we're observing are distressed, and I don't know that that's I think that one of the things the FASB was trying to do was to help clarify what's distressed. But I think that becomes really the big point of contention. I think the auditors also have, in some cases, access to a lot of information because they're dealing with a lot of clients and they're dealing with different sources of information in terms of pricing services and broker quotes. And they can't ignore that information. I think, an investor would be very offended if they ignored that information on a particular client. So I think some of from my perspective, those are, where some of the maybe disagreement comes from.
Peter Prostakis?
Yeah, along that lines, of course, I don't know what the final words will be until we actually draft it, but we are... But we have tried to deal with that a little bit by saying something to the effect of, when the market is significantly decreased, no one price is likely to be determinative. And so we're trying to lead to using multiple approaches and then looking at the variability of the answers that you get with each.
How did you want to interject?
I just wanted to follow up. One of the things I've heard is that, you know, when there becomes this tension or this disagreement in terms of whether that's a distressed price, one approach that I've heard that seems workable to me is that you take the price that's in the market, and then you plug it back into some valuation model, and you look at the assumptions that would be required to get to that market price. If you can show that any of the individual assumptions, for example, one of the assumptions may be that unemployment rate is, to get to that answer, would have to be 14%. And you come back and say, well, it's not likely that unemployment would be 14% to trigger that default to get to that valuation. So you could start to disprove it, but that there's a lot of work involved in that. And what we're hearing is that the auditors aren't willing to go that far. That there is a price, they understand there may be this model out there, but since the model differs from the market price, they're not going back and looking at the individual assumptions that go into it, kind of reverse engineering what you would need to get to that market price. And it just kind of seems to break down at that point. That, again, this is feedback that we're getting.
Sam Renzella, is that?
Let me just respond to that. I think the one shortcoming I see in that approach is the model doesn't comprehend the liquidity discount, the fact that the market, there's so much uncertainty in the market. So if you're looking at, a loan that's secure or a security that's collateralized by a loan, and you look at, or a bunch of loans, and you're looking at all the underlying assumptions about what would happen to housing prices or whatever, you still don't have in that model the discount rate associated with the liquidity discount. Mm-hmm. And that is fundamentally where what the issue is. I mean, I think, the model that they have is it's not fair value. It may be some sort of fundamental value or base value or long-term value, but it doesn't take into account liquidity discount.
Sam, are you ready?
Clearly not. at least not from this report I just heard. I'm going to stay here and write auditing standards. I think how you have to decide when you look at this, do you believe that the prices on the books are just too low and they don't represent an exit price? And that's what you have to believe. And do you think that based on your intent that you can hold a security until a market becomes orderly or active again, that you should end up with a different price on your books than somebody who cannot wait for that market or may not be able to wait for that market? And if you believe that, you ought to get two different answers based on the way in which an entity holds a security, then I don't think you ought to call them both fair value. And I'd be very supportive of another concept around fundamental value, economic value, and inherent value. I'm fine with that. Call it what it is. But I think what we've been, I'll hold judgment, but I don't think what we heard today is going to help the situation very much. At least that's my cut on what I just heard. I don't think this is going to help us deal with this gap very, very well. And so, but without having seen the words, then I think you have to, I'll have to defer judgment.
I'd have to agree. What you're arguing is probably our later discussion about going concern. There's a valuation for going concern, and can I hold on to that and dispose of it in a truly functioning market? I think that's one value. And then there's that liquidation value concept, and very honestly, we're already pricing some companies, particularly banks, at liquidation values. So I would not be opposed to something along those lines. But the market's already doing it. Question is, will the accounting catch up to reflect it?
I would say, though, that there's a difference between a liquidation value and an exit value in the current market, because I would say the use of the word liquidation is pejorative, implying that it is a forced transaction. And if that's right, then we should have allowed the FSB to go forward with where it was. I would argue with you that the observable transactions in the market, not all of those are distressed transactions.
I'm arguing that they all are distressed.
But if you're saying liquidation value, to me, liquidation value is pejorative relative to the term fair value.
I don't know if it's pejorative, but different.
Okay. Okay, I'll go there too.
Okay. Arnold Schilder.
A bit out of the same concern about the auditability, I wondered whether Peter could elaborate a bit more on the expected wording. If I'm reading on page 6 of the handout, paragraph 13, then I'm reading a lot of emphasis on decisions and judgments made by the entity. The entity would conclude whether the transaction was orderly based, and a bit further, in estimating fair value, more weight should be placed on transactions that the reporting entity concludes are orderly. Less weight should be placed on transactions that the reporting entity doesn't have sufficient information to conclude. A reporting entity do not have to incur undue cost and effort in making these determinations. So am I reading this right, that basically the whole emphasis is now with the entity? So, well, this is our judgment and you have to accept it as an auditor? Or how else would that discussion go if the auditor would say, I'm not convinced? And this leaves that discussion pretty open and judgmental. And I wondered whether Peter could elaborate a bit more on whether it more or less will stay like this, which I think is a concern from the auditability perspective, or that it is still open to further discussion, et cetera.
I'm not sure I can opine on how the auditor is going to verify those judgments, but there's no doubt that what this application guidance does is it puts more reliance on judgments that are made by the reporting entity. I think we feel that most of the time you're not really going to have any discrete evidence to be able to determine whether the transaction is distressed or not, but to the extent you can make that assessment, then that will be part of your decision making. All we're really trying to do here is to ever so slightly move away from the natural tendency to go to a transaction price and say there's different ways that you can come up with the value, and you should consider all of that and do some comparisons. And if you have a wide variability, then maybe you need to do more work. But clearly, the press is picking up flexibility and leeway. Yeah, there's flexibility not in the notion of an exit value, but there's flexibility in the approach that you would use to develop it. So I don't have an easy answer.
Thank you. Kurt Schott, I think you're next.
I'm tempted to talk about the standard setting process, but Mark keeps kicking me here. So to keep this in the framework of audits, what is an auditor to do, and will there be a need for some PCAOB guidance on looking at the decision? And I want to talk about the impairment side of this. The intent does not intend to sell the security, and it is more likely than not that the entity will not be required to sell the security before recovery. What does an auditor do with that?
I think, you know, that's a, Finn, did you want to take a? Well, I think, you know, that's kind of the questions we're trying to get at here today, if, you know, if there's anything, you know, what any guidance or anything that might help.
Well, the only thing I was just going to bring up, I mean, today for equity security, I mean, there's a SEC SAB, right? It's topic, I think it's M, right? But SAB 59, that has the notion of ability and intent that's there. And now this notion for debt securities is a little bit different than now the notion for equity securities. But, I mean, we've been doing that for a while. I'm just saying that that particular concept's not a new concept. Don't get me wrong, there is going to be challenges with respect to what has been put out and the auditability around those challenges. I mean, we can start at, I think there's an expectation gap between what is probably being picked up in the press and between what, you know, and expectations. Is this going to go further? It does have flexibility on, you know, what you're looking at in the what is distressed or not distressed, but they have reiterated the concept of exit price, and then it's very difficult when you go to, okay, exit price, move and do a model to an orderly transaction, an orderly market, and I think that is a inherently judgmental and very difficult. But a company's got to come up with their assumptions, and we're going to need to review those assumptions like we do in a lot of estimates. But it's going to be very difficult.
Randy Fletchall.
Jennifer, I want to go back to Hal's observation from his calls, what he's heard from various people. There's probably no winning answer I could give here, and so if I was smart, I probably would just keep quiet, but I don't think I can. I'm somewhat pained by what I've been hearing for several months about what auditors are not doing. And I will tell you, Vin just said it, these are very, very tough estimates to audit. And I think auditors are under these very unusual circumstances in a very crazy market are doing a darn good job of trying to exercise judgment and not, in fact, just accept an answer and try to rationalize it with I'm using judgment. We have been talking about a respect for judgment for some time now, and that means we have to act in a manner that says we deserve to have that judgment respected. I think that's what we're trying to do. But each time someone doesn't like that answer, it gets played back as you're scared to exercise judgment. I think we're doing it today, and I think we're doing it about as well as we can in a very, very tough environment with things that are very, very tough to estimate. And that doesn't mean from time to time in some place someone doesn't come up with an answer that they think we might all say, that was a little conservative in that case. But you can't be judged based on what might happen in one place here or one place there when people truly are doing, I think, a pretty darn good job from the vantage point I see, the consultations that take place, the effort that goes into trying to figure out what that best estimate is. It does pain me to hear that, no, you just kind of like to take the last price and go on, and whatever the lower number is better. That's not the way I see it operating, despite what I read and hear.
Thanks, Randy. Galen Hansen.
My twin down here just nudged me a few minutes ago and said, life has just gotten a lot harder for you, Galen, and I think he's absolutely right. And I would agree with what Randy just said. I don't see auditors just inadvertently choosing these values, but I think this is putting us in a situation where we're going to be talking about going concern this afternoon, and instead of talking about 1 year, it'll be 2 or 3 years where we're looking at assumptions out the line in terms of the ability to hold and testing that intent. I have a hard time believing that just accepting somebody's on the paper expression of we intend to hold this is going to be enough from an audit evidence standpoint.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Coleman already answered this, but I thought I'd just ask it again. Relating to the other than temporary impairments, FSP, as proposed, there was a dissent by two of the board members on several issues, and one of the issues that they dissented on, which, as I understand it from Peter, is going to be in the final FSP, is on splitting the impairment loss between the portion of the loss related to credit and then to all other. In the dissent, the proposal, the two board members who sent it indicated that, at least in some cases, if not in many cases, it's really a fiction that you can make that split. So obviously that split is important because, and there's going to be a lot of pressure around that split because one of the numbers goes into net income and earnings per share immediately and the other number doesn't. So there's obviously going to be a tremendous amount of pressure on how that split is done. So my question is, one, do the auditors feel comfortable in auditing that split? And two, will the PCAOB inspection process take a look at the auditor's evaluation of that split, or will there be some evaluation by the PCAOB at some point related to how auditors handle that, what some would claim a fiction? How are they going to audit what some would say is a fiction?
Well, let me look to the auditors that are on the standing advisory group to respond to that split regarding OTTI. Anyone? Jim Schnur? Sorry.
Well, I think the proposal was actually, there was a lot of confusion about how you would do that. I think, I know we responded, I think many of the other firms responded that if you, and I believe in the final standard, while it will not be a requirement, I think there will be, or I believe there will be, the approach towards the credit piece will be expected cash flows, which I think we have experience in auditing. I do have a concern that if somebody were to use another measurement of the credit risk, how we would get comfortable with that, but not having had an opportunity to, understand how, a client would do that or a specialist would do that. It's hard to answer that. But I think if most companies use expected cash flows to make that measurement, then I think we know how to audit that.
Sam, did you want to comment as well?
Well, I agree with Jim, but I think what we know how to audit that and we'd be comfortable with the split using expected cash flows and the discount rate that's inherent in the instrument. And I think one of the misconceptions has on this bifurcation of the change in fair value has been the proposal that you're trying to strip the credit risk from all other risks and just take the credit risk into P&L and put everything else into equity. That is not what is being done. What is being done is to make some provision for an incurred credit loss, like you do on a loan, and put that incurred credit loss through the P&L, and then the rest of the change in fair value. And I think we know how to do that. If we don't, there's loans, portfolios, and loan loss allowances. But to Jim's point, if somebody wanted to go and try to say, I'm going to try to determine the change in credit risk versus all other risks to define that movement between carrying value and fair value, I think that is very, very difficult, and we would struggle with that. But that is not, at least not my understanding of what the FSP will require.
Then you kind of, you're going to comment?
I guess I'd be kind of repeating what they're saying. I mean, I was just going to say it refers to, I mean, we do it today in 114. I think this document, I guess the final document will refer to the 114, but it does say as possible methods. So to Jim's point, it'll be interesting to see where practice goes. So when you ask the auditors, I think the first question is going to be is, what are preparers going to do, right? And evaluate what preparers do. And so we're going to audit what they do. It's not like we're doing a split here, right? And so what is the efficacy of the processes they're going to put in place to separate this, and how wide are the methods going to be? To the extent that there's, that's not very wide, I think our job gets a little bit easier than you into the assumptions. But you start using a lot of different, many, many different models. I think this came up, Gary, at the FASAC meeting the other day. The many models you go, the wider you go, the more difficult it becomes.
I think we'll get back to the main. But Jeff, you had asked another question about inspections, whether or not we would look at that. And I can't answer specifically for inspections program, but generally we have a risk-based focus, looking at engagements, the type of risk areas, and we do look at how auditors audit company's financial statements and internal controls over financial reporting. So I'd expect, if this is an area that's selected, that certainly the audit, you know, that we would look at that as part of the inspection process. Okay. Bill Miller.
Thank you. Yes, with regard to, potential guidance, my sense is this is going to be very complicated. And by way of example, and I'll let the auditors determine whether this is correct or not, but if you go down the path of saying you audit the holdings of B of A, Chase, and AIG, and you're all one audit firm, and another audit firm is doing Goldman Sachs, and let's assume that, you know, these are all complicated structured securities, and that no one entity owns an entire issue, then I guess there's going to have to be some commonality of assumptions. Otherwise, you're going to get valuations for the same security or family of securities valued very differently in one firm versus another, versus one audit firm versus another audit firm, perhaps. And I think, well, it's my view that when you're looking at companies from an investment perspective, you need to have some degree of comparability. So to address that, I think you're going to have some disclosures to help with that.
Gail Hansen. I think my point was along the same line. When management is going to make this determination between the split between, with the other than temporary impairment, between credit and other, and presumably the same security on two different sets of books could be valued differently. And I don't know whether that's anticipated by the FASB or by the accounting firms of saying, can you give an opinion that the same security valued in valued differently on two different companies that you audit is fair? And where do you draw the line saying this company can use that value and that company can use a different value on the exact same security for dividing the other than temporary impairment?
I have a brief comment on that, and I don't think that's a new issue. I mean, I think that's an issue that's been around for a long time, that whether it's evaluation of loan loss reserves or valuing a security, it's up to the preparer to prepare their financial statements and the auditor to come up with the reasonableness of all of those assumptions. And I doubt that the exact same amount is recorded for a security on all institutions today or the same loan loss reserve for similar loans. So I think that's an issue that exists. That's not new.
Gary Kaburek.
Actually, Vin made some of the points I was going to make, but I'll repeat them. I mean, we're talking about difficult to audit. Well, I can assure you as preparers that's equally difficult to create. And although there's audit risk and there's also management risks in the 302 and 906 certifications during the year and so on. So your clients have got the exact same issues. I would argue probably a higher degree of expectations because it's our representations, you know, when the numbers, I just don't want to lose sight of that. I think, personally, I think I'm going through FASAC and stuff. I actually, giving the difficulties, the situation, the collective circumstance, I think actually the FASB has been pretty, very responsive in trying to address these issues as, you know, as quickly as they can. And I think, although it's perhaps more work could be done if time was permitted, I think we're still way ahead of where we might have been 3 years ago. If we didn't have 157 3 years ago, we'd have had a lot more variety in how to value these things, whether it's a net realizable value, a mark-to-market, an estimated value, and so on. So I still think we're collectively better off with where we are off the FASB's discussion today in it. So just a comment.
Thank you. Hal Schroeder.
Just quick observations. My condolences to the audit professionals here. From what my credit people tell me, you're going to have a hell of a time. They kind of just shrugged their shoulders when they read this section and kind of went, what would you like the number to be? And so you're going to get, unfortunately, to your observation, you're going to get a fairly wide range of differences. And these are people who do it for a living, day in and day out. And so what I assume that will happen is that you'll have a fairly extensive summary of audit differences because you will get different clients who have different answers for the same basic investment. You may come back, and I'm guessing you'll come back with what you think the fair number is that is applicable to everybody, and some people will be above that and some people below that, and they'll all end up in the summary of all the differences. And with their material, then you'll make whatever judgments you have to at that point in time. Is that basically how the process would work?
Do the firms want to comment?
Well, I'll try. I don't think that's the way it'll work, Al. I mean, I don't think we are going to sit with one spot, one person sitting somewhere in New York saying, here's the way that security is going to get valued every place it shows up. So I don't think we're going to have a one firm answer that we then consider where a particular client falls in the range. I'm struck by, and I won't get this quote right, but it came from an American Assembly report, and it was something about the brittle illusion of exactitude in financial accounting and reporting. I mean, these things are estimates. You could take two loans held, a participation loan held by two banks, and when it starts going south, as Marcus, then I get exactly the same answer unless it's a shared national credit, and someone does come in and say, this is the valuation you put on that particular loan. This isn't new. It's the times are something we haven't faced before. But you're going to have different valuations by different companies that are accepted by different auditors, or maybe even the same firm, but different auditors. That's happening today. That's going to happen after these FSPs are passed. And there just seems to be a misunderstanding that those financial reports are so precise that couldn't happen. The fact is, they're very relevant, but they're not so precise that you're going to get the same answer on something that is filled with that much estimation.
Damon Silvers.
I serve on another body, the Congressional Oversight Panel for the TARP. In that context, we have looked at comparative U.S. historical and international approaches to banking crises, which it seems to me, and I don't speak for that panel, but just for me, and we've held hearings on this, and one of the things that we have found is that there are two different approaches that have been tried in banking crises to problems of valuation on bank balance sheets, which have implications for auditing. The first approach is essentially administrative pricing, which is more or less what I think we are talking about trying to audit, meaning essentially some form of discounted cash flows associated with the assets. With a non-market measure of what the discount rate is. This only works, historically, in my opinion, if the people doing it are not the management of the firm. If you ask incumbent management to do this, there's only one instance in comparative banking crises that we know of where incumbent management was asked to do this, and that instance was Japan. And it's widely understood to have been a contributor to the prolonged nature of that crisis. We are clearly, in this case, asking auditors to audit the firm's own sort of self-estimate of these numbers. And I think that the likelihood of success is not great based on historical comparison. And I think that furthermore, there seems to be an immediate issue that the board will face in its work overseeing that. And that is that the temptation to look, as someone I think said a few moments ago, to the internal implied discount rates in these securities. If that's the starting point, then it strikes me that none of this will have any integrity whatsoever. You cannot possibly look at the cash flows of impaired securities, of securities that are being priced below par, and then assume that you apply the discount rate that was implied when the security was issued at par. If issuers are starting there, then the board has a very large job in front of it. I think that the seriousness of these issues is very great. If financial reporting, if the output, which is not the same thing as the standard that the FASB has articulated, but if the output that arises at the end of the audit process here is fundamentally not output that can be effectively used, by a variety of decision makers, including, quite importantly, public sector decision makers who are having to decide how much, what to do with sick institutions. If the output is not reliable, the consequences, not just for investors in those firms or the management, employees and so forth of those firms, but the consequences for our economy and for our society may be very great. I don't mean to make anyone here any more depressed than they might otherwise be, but I think that the board has a very great obligation here. The PCAOB has a very great obligation here to ensure that whatever we do not repeat the Japanese experience here, that we get numbers that can be used. And I would further add, just in conclusion, that in parallel with this process, which you all are overseeing, in many of the institutions that are the largest institutions that are most severely affected here, the Treasury Department is in parallel doing stress tests. And if it turns out that there's a real risk to the credibility of the audit process, the audit firms, and the financial reporting system, if numbers start getting generated out of the process that comes out of FASB's changes as mediated through the audit process and through the PCAOB's oversight of that audit process, if the outputs are wildly at odds with what turns out to come from either the stress tests or from potentially much more rigorous sorts of things comparable to those that were used successfully in other process, in other financial rescues that may follow on the stress tests, should we have continuing problems with the balance sheets and overall health of our major financial institutions.
Damon, I know there's a lot of comments in there, and we appreciate them. I think the first thing Mark had said earlier is we will, when we finally see these FSBs, determine, first of all, what conforming amendments are necessary on the auditing standards, but whether additional guidance is necessary. So we will go through that. Just one other point I want to make, and I think that when you were talking about using the rate implicit in the security to discount cash flows, as I understand it, and Peter, you can comment if I get this wrong, that's not for the purpose of determining fair value. That's for the purpose of only determining the incurred credit loss that should be recorded through the earnings statement in the 115 on the other than temporary impairment. So that's that rate is only for that incurred credit loss that should be recorded through earnings, no suggestion that that's the rate that should be used in the determination of fair value. Peter, any?
That's correct.
My concern would be in relation to the question of what rate do you use, right? That it seems to me a very difficult task to figure out how to audit that decision in light of what you've been provided with, and that how one would inspect against those audits seems quite challenging. And what I wanted to emphasize to the board was the enormous stakes here in doing that effectively, and the very real possibility that the success or failure of the process of financial reporting and auditing will not be something that's looked back on in 10 years, but in 10 months.
Wayne Collins.
The discussion we've been having for the last, I don't know, 45 minutes or so, you know, certainly significant in terms of the issue that we're focusing on, but certainly seems like it's part of a broader issue when you're dealing with what is apparently, you know, a principles-based standard that both issuers and auditors have to comply with. And to assess how each one does his or her job in that respect without some kind of a professional judgment framework is a very difficult task. And this will not be the only standard that we're dealing with like that. And, you know, CIPR had that, at least the early recommendation, it kind of evolved a little differently. But for both the PCAOB and the FASB to have some kind of an approach, a framework for making reasoned professional judgments that could be accepted as long as the reason was applied appropriately.
Kurt Schott.
Thanks. I just wanted to say for the record, just to get this out there, that speaking for one user group, I want to just say how much we appreciate the strong job that that audit firms are doing under very difficult circumstances, and we really do look to you as sort of our last line of defense on this. Just for a second, I'm tempted to think about liability limits, but that passes very quickly.
Hal Schroeder.
I don't know if this is the right forum to bring this up in, but Jim mentioned liquidity discounts earlier, and I'm just listening to some of the comments from Damian. This seems to me to have real implications for investors, and Gail and I were talking earlier today. I said, you know, one of the things that I've heard from investors is they make an investment in a hedge fund, and let's say they bought that hedge fund investment at 100. If the price of the underlying securities, and soon they're all very liquid, very actively traded securities, they're all level one assets. If the price of the value of that fund goes from 100 to 115, what we're hearing from investors is the auditors are coming in and putting an immediate liquidity discount on the 115. Even though they're all level one, they're all fair value, we're comfortable with 115. The basis for this, and there seems to be a really inconsistency in practice here, is that you cannot access that money for 3 years. There's a three-year lockup, which is very, very typical. It was agreed upon on the front end. And what I'm concerned about is that there may be pension funds, endowments, and others who come in and say, I make a $100 investment today, and I'm going to, because there's a three-year lockup, there's been no movement in the underlying assets, but I'm immediately going to lose 5, 10, 15%. And so, therefore, I will not make the investment. And so I'd be very curious as to, you know, where do we fall on that spectrum? Is this an accounting issue? Is it an audit issue? It seems to me to be both issues, and this is real life. This is what's happening out there. And we're getting different accounting answers or different audit answers, if you will, from different firms.
Does anyone want to comment on Hal's question? Ian, were you going to make another point?
Well, no, just believe it or not, I just had a reaction. If the thought is that you could put your money in today but can't get it for 3 years, it seems to me that you've given up the use of your money for 3 years without getting anything back. And so, therefore, it seems to me that it's not worth the dollar you put in. I mean, call me crazy.
Okay. No.
Ben Coleman?
Moving the conversation up a level, though, I think that what this does, there's been discussions, I mean, at the FASB around, you know, there's a separate group dealing with valuation, right? And I think that the expertise, I think this is demonstrating, particularly in these difficult times, how I think our profession is going to need to continue to evolve with respect to valuation skills and using, you know, specialists when you get into very, you know, unique and different types of securities. But more broadly, I think the general practitioner's knowledge of valuation, whether it's here, and by the way, there's other applications. This is financial instruments. I mean, we deal with impairments, and there's all sorts of what we've just gone through. I mean, if you go through this year end, you know, back to your overall topic of emerging issues, I mean, we've gone through, you know, a time where the markets, you know, have changed, and there's been impairment analysis and moves to fair value of other assets on the balance sheet, right? And so it has shown a real need for valuation expertise in our profession. I just think that's something that we should all consider and be aware of.
Thanks. Bob Dacey?
I was just going to make a slightly different point earlier. I put my tent down, but I'll answer anyway since I was going before. But in any case, it had to do with in the end, a lot of this will be the interpretation of the language which ultimately comes out in the FASB documents, and whether or not management's interpretation of that language is the same as the auditor's or not. And I guess any time you have new language in a standard, there's always some diversity of practice, and over time it tends to normalize. I guess I don't know if we have an expectation that additional steps should be taken now to try to make that process work faster to get to that point because of the situation we're in or not. But it just seems to me, in thinking of actions the PCAOB may take, I don't think we can do a whole lot in unilaterally here, but trying to figure out how do we work with, again, interpreting that guidance that comes out in the same way. And I don't know how to best do that because I don't think that's typically what's been done.
Phil Miller.
Yeah, I guess I want to respond to your point, Harold, from the standpoint that when we make investments, or my experience with investing in venture capital or real estate or in the liquid hedge funds with large time period gates, and being a long-term investor, if I've got a three-year time horizon there and they're going to tell me they're going to mark it down a little bit, it doesn't particularly trouble me that much. And at the same time, I think there's a little positive incentive there too, because you know, if that goes up a lot, the hedge funds are getting a 2 and 20. It's based on the high water mark, obviously, but they're getting it sooner than they would have. They get it later when it's priced a little less. So there's a little bit of economics there. So I'm not that troubled by that.
Okay, Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Just a comment on Damon's remarks. With respect to whether these two proposals will make the resulting information more reliable or not, most of the financial experts I have spoken to, and again, this is based on the proposals, we don't know what the final language is, but most of the financial experts I have spoken to have said no, these two proposals will not make the information more reliable.
Okay, I don't see any more tent cards. We spend quite a lot of time on this, and it has been an important topic, so I thank you for your input in connection with this issue. I'd like to continue, open up the discussion to emerging issues more generally, things that you all have been seeing or hearing about, as far as what we should be focusing on at the PCAOB auditing issues. So interested in thoughts, comments on other things, emerging issues, and I see Galen Hansen.
I continue here from the smaller filers, and I know that you probably can't tell me anything other than you're thinking about it, but the SEC, there's a lot of questions about 404B and when that's going to kick in, and whether that's going to be this year or not, and if it's just continuing to be uncertain and we don't know, that's fine, but the sooner that that question gets cleared up, the better it's going to be for the small companies.
My SEC colleagues want to address that?
Sure. And be happy to. We're going to, excuse me. Yes, it's very emotional. We get broken up every time. We're obviously going through a very extensive cost study right now. It's taking quite a bit of time. We are very cognizant of the fact that people need to line up resources and need to be given a clear signal. I think this is something that, you know, we are going to study very carefully, and if we're not in a position to reach a decision in a timely manner, I'm sure the Commission will try to clarify that as soon as they can. Absent that, I can't give you any more specifics.
Thanks, Paul. Craig Jonas?
Two pension issues and a point about debt covenants. The two pension issues, first, as we've all been reading about in the paper, a number of pension plans have in recent years invested ever more in so-called alternative investment vehicles, and to the point where some pension plans now have a majority of their assets in alternative investments. I think there is a risk that because the pension assets are netted against the pension liabilities, that the rigor and discipline over the valuation of these alternative assets that reside in a pension plan would be less than if those same assets resided directly on a company's balance sheet. Yet, the impact on the financial statements can be just as significant of an error in the measurement of those kinds of assets. So maybe a reminder to people that, you know, as pension plans have morphed into these perhaps Category 3 type assets, that business as usual and just looking at the pension valuation may not work. We may need to do more robust procedures. I also understand that we're going to have this year, 2009, new disclosure about those Category 3 assets and pension plans, and reminding folks about that might be helpful, because I think they're going to be subject to the Category 3 disclosure requirements. Second point about pension plans is, you know, 'tis the season to be settling and curtailing and restructuring pension plans in response to the financial stress that everybody's under. In my experience, particularly accountants who haven't seen curtailments or settlements of pension plans, the accounting is not entirely intuitive. Has to be studied, and oftentimes consultation with an expert is useful, or you get the wrong answer. I say this because I used to frequently get the wrong answer, and so maybe a reminder about, you know, the importance of study of the standards with regard to curtailments in these circumstances is useful. And then finally, with regard to covenants, you know, a lot of companies have blown through their covenants under the stressful conditions. Those who haven't are right now a lot closer to blowing through covenants than they often were before. Covenants do a couple of things as they get particularly close to being tripped. It certainly sends signals as to where audit risk might reside for companies who might choose to play some games. They're likely to do it in a way that would avoid tripping the covenants, because once they're tripped in these kind of times, it really turns the company upside down. So perhaps a reminder about that would be useful.
Kaylin Hansen. Damon Silvers.
An issue I think I'm fairly certain you haven't thought about in the way I'm going to outline it to you. It's related to the last discussion, but it's not quite the same thing. I'm convinced, based on what I have seen, that in our oversight role I play over TARP, which relates to our mortgage markets, I'm convinced that in many, many cases, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of cases, those who control residential, those who control the management of residential mortgages, are failing systematically to engage in win-win restructurings of those mortgage loans with people who can't afford to pay. I can't figure out why that's true, and I'm not alone in not being able to figure that out. It's one of the great policy conundrums of our time. But I have a suspicion that there is an accounting reason somewhere there. That there is an unavoidable, that when a mortgage is restructured, there is an unavoidable kind of tangibleness to what its new value is, and that has something to do with this paradox. Now, what does that have to do with the PCAOB? It seems to me that in looking at financial institutions and with assets that either are home mortgages or backed by home mortgages, that the failure to engage in restructurings seems to me an indicia that there may be an effort to maintain values for those mortgages that are not actually supportable. That is the only way I can explain the refusal to take actions that could result in 60-70% recoveries in favor of actions that result in 40% recoveries. And this is something. And so this is a question. This is an insight into whether or not, as you look at financial institutions, as to whether or not the valuation of impaired mortgages is actually supportable or not. And I urge you to think about a way to incorporate that into your inspections.
Thank you. Gary?
I would just like to build on something Greg had said earlier when he talked about the expanded disclosures for pension plan footnote assets. Late last year, we took a look at could we actually early adopt the standard. That was seemingly a theme at the time on expanding fair value disclosures. And I would tell you, if you've got a large pension plan, it's going to have alternative assets as part of a normal diversified portfolio. Hopefully not too many, but diversified, you know, alternative assets. If you think real estate, you've got REITs, you've got direct ownership, you might have mortgages inside it, they might be in fixed incomes, asset-backed securities, private equity, and so on and so on. What I would just give the advice to the room, if you've got a pension plan that has these in some consequential amounts, as you go in for the fiscal 09, I think that's when 132R is effective, I wouldn't wait to the end. It's going to be a lot more challenging to do than you're likely to think. I don't know if you need any additional auditing standards on top of it. I mean, I think if we had started a few months earlier, we probably could have gotten there. But, I mean, these things are very difficult to do. I mean, the people that value them, but they don't necessarily line up with the subdivisions inside 157 and so on. So just a heads-up advice is just don't wait too late to get started on it.
That's good. Any other comments regarding emerging issues? Okay, believe it or not, we're going to take a break for 30 minutes because our next session will be the last one on going concern, a panel discussion, and that we are scheduled to have a 2-hour and 15-minute discussion on that. We'll take a break now, and we'll resume in 30 minutes. Thank you.